it.
Didn't get lost on the way. Now, this is a series of teachings, and each week we build on the previous week, but for people who haven't had an opportunity to come previously, you know, don't worry about that. I'm sure there'll be ideas that you can contemplate and find useful. And each time I try to give a few of the major ideas that we've covered previously, but to actually go over it all again, then we'd never get anywhere, we'd never go any further, that is. This teaching is based on a book that I've been trying to write for a number of years now, and recently Brazil, in the University of Fortaleza in the north of Brazil, they asked me to give a series of teachings covering 100 hours, where the book was split up into four 5 day, 5 hours per day, so 25 hours each module. And so recently they just asked to transcribe what I did so that they can actually publish each module as a book, a separate book. So it's getting to be quite extensive, this teaching. Before I thought it's going to be, you know, maybe a book of about 120 pages, but now it seems to be growing day by day. And really, it's about ego psychology. What is the fundamental makeup of our ego? How does it work? Why we perceive things in certain ways? Why we consider there to be a world out there that exists independent of our own perception? Why? You know, why do we see things in certain ways? We never really question, why do we see things in certain ways? Why do we react to things in certain ways? Now our responses to different phenomena are so fast, we don't even know what we're doing. We don't even know why we get upset or agitated under certain conditions. We don't understand why certain things make us feel good and other things make us feel bad. We never question. We just react, and that's the way it is. And we just continue to feel all these emotions or frustrations or whatever. And very seldom do we question why. Is it necessary? Is there a way that we can reduce this and finally eliminate these kind of conditions that produce these kind of responses, be free of all these conditions that produce these kinds of responses that cause us a lot of pain and suffering? We don't have to go through all this. We don't have to experience this suffering. But at the moment, the way we see things, then we react so fast that there's no other way than to experience whatever we're going through. So we start with the same idea. Anybody remember the idea that we start with? Every week I say the same thing. Now you tell me what I say in the beginning. See if you can remember what I say. Anybody remember? Eric? Rodney?
You can't experience anything without having a thought about it.
Yeah, go on. A little bit more. What does that thought mean? How does that thought work in relationship?
That thought works to create a dualistic relationship between you and another thing, creates another thing.
So, if we explain that more clearly, you cannot experience anything in your life unless your mind interprets it to be a certain way. Mm. Now, every week I'm going to ask you to contemplate this, because it is essential to understand this. If you want to go deeper into these teachings, you have to understand how your own mind, this process, what we call mind, creates all our experience. There is nothing that is not created by our own mind. Everything that we experience in our life is actually a manifestation of our own mind, because it is a mental projection, or what we call mental fabrication. All experience is a mental fabrication. That means that in order to know that you are experiencing something, your mind has to tell you, this is a this, and I feel good about this, or I feel bad about this, or I don't like this, or I like that. That's your mind telling you all this. So all your experience depends on your mind. So we can say the source of all experience is your own mind. Nothing external. Now, for us, ever since we were a child, we have been conditioned to believe that there is a world out there that exists independent of our own mind. It just is the way we see it. It just is, you know, it's a beautiful picture. It's a horrible environment. It's a very nice person. It's a frightening situation. Now, whatever you think, you believe it to be that way in that moment, and then you react to it. If you think something is frightening, it will appear threatening to you, and you will want to push it away from you. You won't want to deal with it. Yet. The thoughts come so fast, and then the thoughts act as if they are filters on our perception. So they make us see things in certain ways, and then we react to it. This is everything in our life, constantly. All the ups and downs in our life created by our own interpretation of what's happening. One minute you think something good is happening in your life, and then half an hour later that same thing can appear to you as something bad. And then it makes you feel, you know, disgusted or something like this. Yeah. Whereas before it gave you such pleasure. That same thing. Now why does it change so much? Why does the appearance of that object change so much from something that gives you pleasure 1 hour and then an hour later it causes you pain? Why? What is it? What's changing here?
Your interpretation.
Yes, but it's not obviously, is it? It's not obviously. Because if it was obviously, we wouldn't react to it, would we? So, the point is, we believe that there's a reality, that it is like that. Whatever we think it is, it's like that. And then the response is so fast, so fast. Can you see? The only way you can see how it works is by looking at your daily life situations. And this is what we're doing. We come back continuously to experiential knowledge. This is not just some intellectual pastime. This is looking at your own experience, looking at your own reactions. You know, why? Why do I feel so sad? What produces these feelings? Why do I reject some people and feel such desire towards other people? Because we have this framework of our mental fabrication. Yes, this is like this. And as soon as you say that, it becomes solid to you. It becomes real. It becomes as if it exists on its own side, independent of your own thought process, your own mental projection. So we have to understand all the components that come together so fast, you know, in a fraction of a second. Many conditions come together. And the feeling that it produces is there's a world out there, and there are people out there, and they all exist independent of my own mind, of my own perception. So fast. If we understand the process, then slowly we can, you know, we can see we don't have to get lost in this process. We can just have a little bit more space, just a little bit more relaxation to actually see what's happening. And the more we don't react, then the more we see clearly, and the more the habit of reacting is reduced. Because now our habits are so strong, our habits of perception are so strong. Even though intellectually we may know something, emotionally, no, emotionally, it doesn't matter. You know, we just react, because we've always reacted. When something appears to us as threatening, we've always tried to push it away from us. We've never just thought to ourselves, I'm going to sit with this and try and understand this. When we feel desire for something, how many times do we actually sit with it and actually watch how the desire comes up? What happens? All the conditions that are necessary for this object to appear desirable. No, we've never done that. We just follow the desire. I want that. That's going to make me feel good. And then we get lost. Yeah? And then if what we consider to be desirable rejects us, my goodness, the pain. Because we have this idea about, you know, if I have that, that is the answer to my happiness. That is the answer to my pleasure. Yeah. Very interesting how it works. So in the Buddhist tradition, especially in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we always start with motivation. Because we don't understand the importance of intention or motivation. We really don't. We don't see how it works and why it's necessary to check your motivation or your intention behind your actions. How does your motivation or your intention act as a filter on your perception? For example, you come here and your intention is to feel good, you know, to feel some kind of pleasure. Maybe you come here because you're feeling insecure, and you expect by coming here, I'm going to give you something that's going to make you more secure. It's going to make you more comfortable. And then you don't get it. And then what you get is a feeling of more insecurity. Or you get a feeling of displeasure. Now, what happens if your intention is to find pleasure? What happens when you don't get what you want? What happens?
You back off.
You back off, right? You won't come back again because it's not what you want. It's not what you intended to get. So then, you become blinded. You don't want to listen. You don't want to work with the feelings that are coming up because your intention was to come here and have a good time. And you didn't have a good time. So something must be wrong. You see how it changes? It changes the way you see things. Now, if I say to you, our intention should be, a positive intention should be, I'm coming here to work with my own confusion. Now what does that mean? You know, that leaves the situation wide open, doesn't it? It means working with whatever is coming up in your life. Whatever. The situations that cause pleasure, the situations that cause pain, happiness, unhappiness, whatever it is. The point that we're here is to work with our own confusion. And what does it mean, confusion here? It means not seeing the nature of the phenomena, not seeing the true aspect of the phenomena, not seeing what is actually happening moment by moment. What we see is only our interpretation. It's only an idea of what is happening. So, this is what we call confusion. When you get lost in your ideas, when you believe your ideas to be the actual reality of the situation. So you can see that confusion, as it stands, is our life at the moment, because the way we see life is totally confused. We do not see clearly. We do not see the true aspect of the phenomena, and we don't even see the relative aspect of the phenomena. We don't see how the phenomena only arises to us under certain conditions. Now, I can only feel bad if something is arising that I don't like. Think about this. We've got to have conditions to produce experience here. So, why do some people offend me? Because I don't like what they say. I don't like what they do. So it depends on conditions. When they do something I like, then immediately the way I see that person changes. Then they become a very agreeable person. I like to be with that person. I get a lot of pleasure from being with that person because they do what I like. And then they do something I don't like again, and then I back off again. Yeah? I feel threatened again. So the experience depends on certain conditions.
I've had occasion where I've looked across the room at someone I didn't know and gotten a very, very negative impression, not based on anything they said or didn't say. I don't want to know this. And I've had that happen, not a lot, and in a couple of cases, my impressions were validated, at least by other people that were in association with these people. That doesn't strike me as cognitive, but rather on a more energetic level, and I'd like you to address that.
No, I think, personally, I think it's really... If you understand how the mind works, you will see that there's a lot of ideas in there. There's a lot of ideas to even interpret that that person is disagreeable in some way. You must have something that's telling you that person is disagreeable.
No, it could be visual, definitely. But it's a sense, and then, of course, the interpretation comes about the sense.
Yes, it still seeds in your consciousness. It still seeds in your eighth consciousness that act as filters. Because if that person was actually, okay, you're validated by other people around you who think, you know, they also feel threatened by that person in some way. But there are other people who won't see that person in that way. If that person actually existed in that way, everybody should see the same way.
Sure.
Yeah. And this is what we don't understand. We think if two or three people have the same kind of perception, then it must be real.
All right, I take your point. But don't you... I'm just trying to expand this beyond the... acutely cognitive to just other levels of perception, extrasensory perception, if you will, as well. Not either or, but both ends.
Well, I think you would find when you begin to understand how this process called mind works, these eight consciousnesses, no, there isn't. These seeds are all in your eighth consciousness, and they will be interpreted consciously or subconsciously.
So it's another level of consciousness.
It's all the seeds are there. There is absolutely, you cannot react to anything. All experience, whatever it is, only functions when there's dualistic fixation. Please understand this. All experience. You cannot experience anything unless you believe there's an object there. All right? So, in order to have an object, what do you have to have? You have to have a thought. Yes? You can't have an object without a thought. As soon as you have an object, you're going to have a perceiver of the object.
Is the object separate from you, though? It can't be, really.
This is what we think. This is why we suffer, because we believe there's something there, independent of our own perception. But the more we understand how the mind functions, we see that there is nothing there that exists independent of our own perception. Yes. So we're not saying that nothing exists. We're saying nothing exists independent of certain conditions. You have to have these conditions present in order for this kind of perception to arise, for this kind of appearance of the phenomena, the thing, whatever it is. Okay, but we don't understand this. We don't take into account all the conditions that are necessary in order to see things in certain ways. We just think it just exists like that. And because we see things as something solid, then we don't feel the flexibility, we don't feel the flow, we don't feel the changing nature of the phenomena. We don't see how we're creating it with our concepts.
So the object is not separate from the observer, because we create the perception of the object.
Yeah, not separate. Because if you take away the observer, what is the object? Is there such a thing?
So, tree falls before us and no one hears it as well.
Yes, yes. We have, it's interdependent. This whole idea in the Buddhist tradition, interdependent. Everything depends on conditions to arise in certain ways. Every phenomenon.
So the object is part of you in your perception.
Sorry?
The object is a part of you in some way.
The object is like a projector in a movie. Projector is the mind, and that constantly with your ideas you project outwards, believing that the movie is something separate from the projector. And it happens so fast that it continuously kind of recreates the objective world because of the speed. And this is what we're going to talk about today. So, this is why we're here. If we understand this motivation, then we have a much more open way of listening to the teachings, because we're not going to run away from the displeasure, because the displeasure is also a phenomena that we need to deal with. The boredom, the frustration, all these so-called negative feelings that come up are also part of our confusion. And this is, we need to work with whatever is arising to try and understand the true aspect of the phenomenon, not just the interpretive aspect. Is that clear?
I'm still hung up on the tree falling in the forest, to be honest. The tree falling in the forest, or the volcano rumbling away underneath the earth a million miles away from us. But you know,
why is that?
Because at the moment what we're hearing is that all these things only exist as part of our awareness. And,
right.
And I'm thinking back to his holiness the Dalai Lama's answer, where he was saying in the passage that Graham identified that these objects have their own continuums, which are in some senses existing. It seemed to me, in my understanding of what he said, existing independently, therefore, of our awareness of them.
No, I never understood that from his teachings. Nothing is independently existing.
I pay for a flight. Whether I show up or not, that flight is going to take off.
It's got nothing. It's still. I'm not saying that it's not going to take off. But I'm saying that the way that you see it depends on conditions. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't just exist like that. It depends on its conditions.
But because we're not omniscient, we don't have that privileged view.
That's right.
Yeah.
So then it appears
like taking off without us. Yeah. And so I'm still not clear as to whether, in your scheme of things, or the way you're describing it now, as I understand it, that flight is taking off because and we're not perceiving it.
No, the point is we're getting lost here. It's very, we misinterpret this time and time again. I've heard these same questions when we come to a certain part of the teaching. These same feelings come up. It's very hard to digest this. You know, we want something to exist because if something exists, then of course we're here to perceive it. You don't know there's a volcano unless somebody tells you that is a volcano. You don't know that is erupting unless somebody explains to you that is a volcano erupting. Okay? So in this sense, on a conceptual level, we have to have the perceiver. It depends on the perceiver to interpret the experience to be a certain way. Do you understand?
So if we're not perceiving it directly, somebody else has perceived it for us and we've agreed with that.
You've agreed. You've been conditioned to believe that this is happening like this.
Okay.
And so immediately anything similar that arises, you will interpret it. That is actually happening like that. Right? But when you don't know what it is, then how can you interpret it in that way? You don't. And so it depends on conditions.
So what is it when you don't know what it is?
That's what you have to ask yourself. This is, you know, the baby-like attitude I keep trying to introduce here. People don't want the baby-like attitude. They want something that they can hold on to because it makes them feel secure. This is the whole point. We don't want to see that there isn't an objective world out there because we have nothing to play with. The ego has nothing to play with. And so we have to recreate the objective world over and over again. In each moment, we have to believe there is something out there and it exists the way we think it does. Because then I must be here to perceive it.
When 9/11 happened, I think people were, particularly in New York, people were flabbergasted because it didn't fit into their expectations. It was beyond their context. And it was deeply traumatizing. Of course, it's traumatizing at other levels too, and there's no question, but I'm just speaking from a positive aspect.
Loads of the Hollywood disaster films have executive kind of stuff. There were no new, I didn't see new concepts there.
What? You have to be there.
America's been imagining disasters through Hollywood films.
But
never
directly experienced it.
What does that have to do with 9/11?
You were saying the concept
9/11 was beyond imagining.
Was it? No, it wasn't beyond imagining. No, I don't think so.
I think for people,
in,
I mean, given the amount of trauma that happened, I think part of it was it was so hard to imagine integrated into consciousness because it was so outside.
No, I think it's the opposite. I think that they had spent so much time imagining things like happening that when it happened, it seemed to be a certain way. Exactly. There've been so many movies, and how do you? And then it happens, and it actually is real.
Yeah.
Like the people are really dead.
I don't think we're in disagreement. Actually, I think what you imagine is one thing, and they could not integrate that it was actually happening. They didn't have any kind of preconceived context for it, even though they had movies. This was something that so violated their egotism as a country, you could say. But I'm just talking about the subsequent trauma, that it was just, as opposed to poor people in Bosnia and where else, Baghdad was being bombed every other minute, it is part of their worldview. And so I think when something happens so far out of your conceptual frame, it can be deeply traumatizing.
I think it can be deeply traumatizing, but I'm not so sure this was so much out of their conceptual frame. And I think that the way they reacted was in doing exactly what those guys in the movies did.
Well, actually being there when it actually happened, I think that was I saw a woman jump and kill a firefighter on the way down, and for me that was the biggest... That was the biggest conundrum, was when I watched this woman who chose to jump to her death instead of burning, and then she, her last moments were falling on top of a firefighter and killing him, was very hard for me to accept. But because I think I would have jumped too, actually, instead of burn. And I know it's not good to like kill yourself, and then to have your last moment. Not I'm free, but oh, I'm going to kill another human being is like the worst, you know. And I don't think I could have. Well, I saw it, but I didn't really imagine it. But it introduced some very interesting things to deal with. And I think when you experience it personally, it's just different. That's all. And I think it teaches you a lot.
Okay, now what we're saying here, whether we're using this in relationship to any phenomena, we just took a more traumatic phenomena there, because a lot of people died.
Yeah.
But in the sense of, you're all sitting here, and you're all looking at me, and you're all seeing me in a different way. Every single person in this room sees me in a different way. Some people will like me, some people dislike me, some people find me interesting, some people find me boring. So the point is, what makes us see in such different ways? We think we're looking at the same object, but we all see in a very different way. We all see the room in a different way. We all see each other in a different way. This is what we're trying to understand. If something is real, this definition, if something is actually real, if something really exists, we should all see it the same way. Please try and understand this definition.
Do you think that people who witnessed that woman jumping saw it in a different way?
Yes, totally. Mm-hmm. Totally different way. Every single person.
Every single person
would see it in a different way.
Some people would think it's a success.
Yeah.
But they would still agree that the person had jumped to their death.
Some people would think it's glory.
That's an evaluation, that's not what I mean.
But that's someone seeing it a different way.
In perceiving it or interpreting it differently. But
you,
what I'm asking is,
you
would there be a consensual of perception that the person jumped?
No, you can't see that with your eyes.
Not even that.
You cannot see that with your eyes.
I don't know.
We've gone over how the senses work before, and we realize that we can't see any object with your eyes. You cannot see a woman. You cannot see somebody jump. With your eyes, you can't see that, Melanie. It's all concept. And we're going to go over this again, because this is what we need to go over, because we can't hear it, This is another thing. We can't hear what's being said. Why can't we hear what's being said? because we have all these filter systems, all this conditioning that won't allow us to hear what's being said, because it threatens us in some way. It threatens the way the ego psychology functions, this process. We have to have this dualistic fixation.
And when you say that what we see depends on conditions,
yes.
can you explain more about the conditions? Because to me it sounds like the conditions are now something independent that are happening and are creating that perception.
Yes, this is, if you let me go on, this is what we're going to try and start today, if we can. And we're talking about, as I say, we're talking about the components of ego psychology. So the first component is, in order to have a self, we have to have other than self. Please just try and understand that for a moment. You can't have something other, something out there, unless there's something to perceive it. Now, how does this come about? This is the meaning of form. This is the first aggregate of ego psychology. We've got to have a basis. And that means we have to have a basis for this idea of self. In order to have an idea of self, you have to have other than self. Now, how does it come about that we feel that there is a world out there? There's an objective experience. That there's something there to be experienced, out there. This is what we're looking at today. Right. So, check your motivation for being here. Try to understand that by working with your confusion, you diminish your confusion, which means you don't share that level of confusion with others around you. The more you work with your confusion, the more you benefit other beings, because you don't share your confusion with them. And this is how we benefit others, in a very profound way. It's not about going out and saving the world. By seeing things in a different way, then everything is transformed continuously, every time. We remove our negative attitudes, then, you know, the energy is very different, the way you relate to things, the way you relate to people. You can feel when you're agitated and you go into the office in the morning, then you probably hit your toe on the desk, shut your finger in the refrigerator. You know, all these things will probably happen, you know, just because our awareness is so decreased through our negativity. And yet when we feel good, then the way we see people around us, the way we see situations, we see a much more positive life. We have much more time for people. Isn't it like that? So, a lot changes by our attitudes. So, this is what we're doing. We're working with the way we see. Dharma, now this word Dharma, which usually refers to the teachings in Buddhism. Here, I'm using a definition, a different definition. I'm using the word phenomena. So what we're doing here is we're studying phenomena, which means we study things. We practice things, that's all. We're studying how things arise as experience itself. What is perception? What is feeling? What is concept? What is consciousness? This is phenomena. This is things that we study. All right, so today we start by looking at form. And it's kind of discussing the origin of all psychological problems. Yes, we would never think that this word form, this concept, was the origin of all psychological problems. Because we deal with psychological problems on a symptomatic basis. We don't look at the root cause of neurosis. We look at, you know, the symptoms of schizophrenia or depression or whatever. We don't really get back to the root cause. The root cause, according to Buddhist psychology, is dualistic fixation. As soon as you have an object, that is the cause of all your neurotic tendencies. As soon as you believe an objective world out there, that is the cause of all your neurotic tendencies. So we're looking at the origin of the neurotic mind. Now, this is the tendency to identify oneself with desires and conflicts related to an external world. Please think about this. Desires and conflicts related to an external world. The origin of a neurotic mind. So then we need to ask ourselves the question whether such conflicts actually exist as something internal or something external. Where are these conflicts? What do you think? Internal or external? All your desires. Then why do we depend so much on the external phenomena for our pleasure?
Habit.
Yes, habit. Where does the displeasure come from?
Habit as well, not getting what we want.
Not getting what we want. So, we're not even clear on this, are we? We're not clear on where our conflicts come from. We constantly blame. We constantly blame an external appearance of an object, whether it's a situation or a person, whatever it is. We blame that for our displeasurable feelings. This is the reason why I'm unhappy. And the same way we look at something that's desirable and we believe that by having it, that is the cause of our happiness. This is what's going to give me pleasure. And we do this in all our relationships. Constantly. This is going to cause me displeasure and having this is going to cause me pleasure. Look what we do. This is our daily life. Pulling and pushing all the time. Pulling things that you want and pushing things away from you that you don't. So here we have this question. Whether conflicts actually exist externally or whether they are internal. We need to be clear of this. Because otherwise you won't work with whatever is coming up. You will always go back to your old habits until you really understand yourself that they are coming from something internal. Our habits are so strong. So strong. Always pushing things away from us that we don't, you know, that appear to us as threatening. If it's threatening, then it's undesirable, then it is the cause of some kind of displeasure, some kind of pain. Isn't it? Isn't that the way we think? You tell me. Tell me how it works. Why is it undesirable? What makes it undesirable? Look at your own experience. Tell me, what makes it undesirable?
Your thoughts about it?
Your thoughts about it. It's really quite simple. You have an idea. And you believe in your idea. And then you try to push what you consider to be undesirable away from you because it appears to you as something threatening. It makes you feel insecure in some way. Look at your own experience. Come back all the time to your own experience. All the Buddhist teachings are like this. They ask you, come back to your own experiential knowledge. Don't just leave it as an intellectual pastime. So, the uncertainty of not knowing whether it's internal or external, it makes the problem more solid. This feeling of not knowing solidifies this problem of how to relate to what's going on in your life. Because if you knew it was internal, you'd know, right, I'm going to work with it in this way. But now you don't know whether it's internal or external. Yeah?
Well, we don't have to blame ourselves, do we? We always want to point the finger somewhere else.
Yeah, why? Why?
Well, because it offends us, doesn't it?
Yeah, but why? Go on.
My ego.
Okay, exactly. It threatens this idea of self. It makes you feel insecure.
Yeah.
This is the whole thing. We don't want to work with insecurity. Can you see how it works?
And as you brought this up, can I just ask you something, please, Alexander? Say if I had a relationship with someone, you know, someone came into my life, but I was so worried about losing this relationship that I couldn't really experience this relationship properly.
Yes.
What's happening with my mind in this way?
Full of ideas again, isn't it? Insecurity. Believing that, you know, if the person is a certain way, then everything's going to be fine. Not willing to deal with the person, you know, the way that they are. You don't know the way they are because you have so many ideas about them. Usually we don't have a relationship with another person. We only have our relationship with our ideas about the person. True. Doesn't really matter if there's a person there or not. Seriously, that's the way it works, the mind, if you look, if you're honest. It's all about what you think about the person. All your ups and downs, all your emotional conflicts, it's all about what you think about the person. You have to have that object. And you will create that object, no matter how you do it, through all your neurotic tendencies, in order to feel secure. So you will create the object as threatening, you will create the object as desirable, through jealousy, through this, through that. Sexual desire. It's all about insecurity. Sorry. If we want to see how our confusion works, we need to be honest with our own experience. We need to look at how our experience functions. And we can be free of all of this. So here we have the question. What is real and what is not real? We don't ask this question. Not when it comes to our own experience. Why? Why don't we ask this question? Because we want it to be real. Do you understand why we want it to be real? We want that person to be the way we think they are, because it will justify our experience of that person.
We want them to be the way that we think they are.
Yes. Because then we have a basis for our idea of reality. Then we have a basis for our reactions, and we have, you know, then it makes this feeling of self secure. There's something here, perceiving something there. Very clever, this trick, how it works, the trick of ego psychology. Very clever.
So we can't say hell is other people.
No, you can't.
Can't say what?
Hell is other people. So we would say hell is our perception of other people.
Yeah. That's all the realms. When you look at the Buddhist iconography of the Wheel of Life, they're not talking about external states. But then we would also say this present environment is a mental projection. The way we see this is a mental projection. So the same as a hell realm. A hell realm is a mental projection. It's about seeing everything as threatened. Everything that you don't like that causes you pain. That is hell. And heaven is everything that you like, that you want, that gives you pleasure. You see this room, you like this room, then somebody comes along with a magic marker and puts a big black thing on the wall, and then you don't like this room anymore. You want to change it.
Or that person causing.
That's right. Or the person. Isn't it? Then you hold a grudge, long time. That's the person who put the black mark on the wall. Or drop the wine on my carcass. Or whatever it is. It's not easy to let go of. Yeah, but it changes. You see, it changes the way you see the environment. You think something is beautiful in a certain way. And when it changes, unexpectedly or whatever else, you can't deal with it anymore. So then it becomes disagreeable. Then you have to do something about it to make it agreeable again. You've got to have to color the mark or something, whatever it is. Everything is like that. Every relationship is like that. Somebody does something that you find disagreeable, then you have to do something in order to either protect yourself in some way or try and manipulate the other person in order that they will do something that you like again.
It's tricky.
It's tricky. You can't do it. But we try to do it, yeah, because we believe that our happiness comes from something external. So we're always trying to manipulate the other person to get them where we want them to be. And it ends up being so frustrating.
So is the idea that just to sit it out there?
It will get beautiful.
Yeah.
I think if you want, the relationship to go on a more profound level, then, yes. But you both need to have the intention to sit it out and work with it and understand, you know, that it's all coming from confusion.
No set expectations. No
set expectations from the other person. It's very difficult.
Yeah,
very difficult in a relationship. But it really, you know, I think it will take your relationship to new levels. You don't run away every time the person does something you dislike. This is what we mean by so-called unconditional love. You don't run away every time somebody does something you dislike. It doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't depend on conditions. You understand this? Unconditional means it doesn't depend on conditions. That's compassion. If you can really, you know, work with your feelings and you don't get lost in your projections, then the way you see it changes considerably. All right, so what is real and what is not real? I think this is this idea of self's biggest problem. It'll always be ego's biggest problem to try and find out what is real and what is not real. And we will always have a problem until we see more clearly whether the problem is internal or external. So here, this whole teaching is based on a view, and the view is the view of egolessness. Now, goodness me, that's a big long word, isn't it? We've got ego and we've got egolessness. What does that mean?
Less ego.
Less ego. Good. Egolessness. All right. Well, for most people, it would mean, I think, if they could ever fathom the concept, it might mean the absence of ego. Egolessness. Absence of ego.
Why got less then? Why just do away with ego altogether?
Ego-ness. Well, you can't have ego-ness. No. That means more ego.
I mean, don't use another word instead of ego-less.
Anyway, Graham, let's have a linguistic.
Ego without-ness.
Sorry, I'm afraid I'm not a linguistic. I don't know why that word is used. Sorry. But here...
Yeah, when you put less in front of them now, and it means less. When you put it after, it means no at all. It's strange, isn't it?
I didn't know that. Mm.
Is it kind of reaffirmed that there was once, and there isn't now?
Egoless. Yes, it's a negation.
Yeah. But even that's incorrect. Because the basis that we're working on is an illusion. So it never existed. But what we're actually looking at here is we're not just looking at the absence of ego. We're looking at the absence of ego and ego's projections, both. Now, in Western psychology, I don't think this is their approach. So, does the absence of ego arise in this teaching that we're going to go through now. How does it arise, the absence of ego? It arises as a byproduct of seeing the insubstantiality of your projections. Please understand this. We're not going to approach this idea of self directly. So what we're going to do is we're going to see that our own projections, the way we see the objective world, has no substantiality. When we see that, then automatically the idea of self also dissolves. Any questions here?
I have a very silly example. Let's say you have a friend and he's always late. And you know the next time you meet up, he's going to be late.
Yeah.
Or maybe not even show up at all. So that's also perception, isn't it,
yeah,
to some extent?
Yes.
So how do you deal with that? Could you just, by not having that perception, negate it, the whole phenomenon?
Well, you know, you realize that that causes you some agitation. But you know you're not going to change him if that's, you know, that's his habit. Then, you know, why are you getting so frustrated that he's late? Because you know it's going to be late anyway. So, I mean, you're working with your own feelings about what this person does. It's the only way that you're going to be happy, you know, getting him there on time. Does your happiness depend on having him there on time? You have to look at these things. You know, it shouldn't depend on that. You should be happy whether he's, you know, late or early. It doesn't matter. You should be able to just be able to sit peacefully. But now our happiness depends on all these things. So when something happens that we don't like, then we get so frustrated, so agitated, so angry. And it's not really the cause of the anger, is it? What do you think?
Well, that's difficult because even before the next time he's late, you're already annoyed, you know?
Even the week before you're supposed to meet him, you're always building up for the time you're going to meet him.
Then it depends on how much happens you get from that person when you meet them, whether you put up with that or not.
Maybe you enjoy being annoyed.
Yeah. Otherwise, you might not get annoyed, but if you, but if you, you could also say, I'm not meeting you again because you don't have enough respect. So you've got 2 hours late, so I'm not coming next week.
Yeah, you could do that. Why not? But you have. I think it's important to understand where the source of the problem is.
But if you do that, you spend energy on it.
No, you don't have to.
No.
It's up to you if you spend energy on it or not. Or you could be really, really late.
That's what I mean. Then you spend time thinking about it. It's
kind of manipulation.
It might be more beneficial for him if you weren't spending too much energy thinking about that and you just said what you felt.
No, I was kind of wondering if maybe in a Tibetan Buddhist philosophy, really, you bring it about yourself, this person being late. That could be the case, couldn't it?
If he knows you're going to wait for another time.
isn't there some sort of, I don't know the right word for it, like a rule, whatever you try and push away will come back harder?
Well, it does magnify itself,
right,
because you have aversion towards it, so it has to be something.
Is it more important?
Well, whatever you're pushing away,
yeah,
right?
You empower it, don't you?
You're empowering, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but Maria's suggestion about saying, to me, that also sounds a bit egocentric, because the underlying, the covert suggestion is, well, they're causing me displeasure.
But
so I'm going to...
No, but I'm with you, but there's another point where if you let someone do something all the time, are you actually helping them?
Yeah. I don't disagree at all. I'm just thinking that in pulling away, we're also seeking to avoid any more displeasure with this person.
Yeah, that's right.
And seeking to maintain a sense of tranquility in ourselves and in our relationship. So it's very subtle, I think, to find a middle path.
Oh. It depends what your motivation is for saying whatever it is you're going to say. If your motivation is that, then you'll say it with that motivation. If you're, you know,
it's very hard not to have motivation.
No, but there could be the motivation where you're trying to, if this person's always late and it's happening throughout his life.
Okay.
I find that even charging when they're late doesn't work. It's okay. So I can be late.
Really?
Professionally?
Charging when they're late. Anyway, we all have to find ways to work with our situations. But I think we need to understand the source of the problem, that it's not something external. We have to be really clear on this. And then, you know, if you understand that, then if you, with a clear motivation, you then tell the person, right, I'm not coming anymore or whatever else. You know that the actual problem of the frustration comes from your own mind. But you can say very clear to the person, I'm sorry, I can't wait for you any longer or whatever else. But at least we might get a little bit to the root of the problem. It'll help the tendencies from arising again and again when things don't work out the way you want them to work out. Otherwise, you just transfer that. Somebody's late, somebody does something else you don't like, somebody else, you always have that tendency of blaming the person and not looking at the source of the problem, the source of the frustration or the agitation. You understand the difference?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so once we see that the projections of ego are transitory and transparent by nature, then the idea of self will also become transparent, because there's no reference point. There's nothing to relate to. Please understand this. See how it works, this mechanism. If your projections, you see the projections as constantly changing, but they have no substantiality from their own side, the idea of self has nothing to play with anymore. And so, also, the power that we give to this idea of self will decrease and finally dissolve. There has to be an object for the self to play with, and we empower the object, we make it solid, we make it substantial, we make it self-existent. So egolessness is a byproduct of seeing the transitory and transparent nature of the phenomena, the projection. This is why in Tibetan Buddhism we work over and over again on our relationships. If it's the Mahayana tradition, then we're constantly using our relationship with other beings as our path to developing compassion, as our path to developing wisdom. Because you see how the mind projects. The more you understand that sentient beings are your projection, that really there is nothing out there that exists independent of your own mind, then you begin to see this element of wisdom, what we call wisdom, the emptiness of the phenomena. the empty nature. And then just your this mechanism of mind that works on dualistic fixation begins to relax more and more. As it relaxes, then slowly everything opens up. More open, more spacious. You don't buy into this habit. You don't buy into this tendency, this mechanism. But the only way is, first of all, to see this transitory nature of phenomena. This is why I keep stressing to you, so important to just sit and watch how everything arises and passes away, arises and passes away, changing, constantly changing, everything's changing. Nothing remains the same. If you really appreciate this, then you're not going to cling on. You're not going to fixate on certain things being a certain way, because you know they're changing moment by moment. You know your perception's changing moment by moment. There's nothing there. There's no basis for all your projections. How can you say a person is a certain way when you understand impermanence? How can you say that?
Temporary insanity.
Temporary insanity. But how temporary are we talking about?
We like holding grudges. We like to think they're going to be like that forever and ever and ever when they're not. So I would have to say temporary.
We just don't see how temporary it is. We don't see what conditions are necessary for that person to appear that way in that moment. In that moment, a fraction. Second, a 500th of a second. Not even that, we couldn't even lose it. As it arises, it's gone. But we don't allow it to just arise and go. We hold on and we solidify. And we make it into something, and we build with our concepts. This person's like this. And then we have all our reference points. We don't want to see the changing nature of the phenomena. We want it to be solid. And in order to be solid, we've got to have lots of becauses. This person is no good because they ignored me. Because... Isn't it? How could you have somebody you dislike, and you really dislike that person, unless you have a lot of becauses? Think about this. There's nothing to build. There's nothing to construct with, unless you have all these reference points. They didn't do that. They should have done this. They speak too loud. They don't dress right. Their eyes aren't. They're strange. Strange eyes. Funny hair. Whatever it is. Smell.
Late.
Yeah. Anything to construct with. We've got to have ammunition. And ammunition is all these reference points, all these ideas. Because. And it's the same with somebody that you desire. Oh, that person is gorgeous. That's not enough, is it? Not one word is not enough. You've got to have because. In order to have a misperfect or a Mr. Perfect in your vision, you've got to have a lot of becauses. Because he cares about me. Because he sends me flowers. Because he rings me every night. because he's there when I need him. Because he supports my life. And then a few of those reference points changes. Yeah. Well, he didn't do that. Yeah. He should have done that. Then the vision of Mr. Perfect becomes Mr. Imperfect, or Miss Perfect becomes Miss Imperfect, because it doesn't live up to all my reference points. And you see how it works. Look what you're doing. Look what we're doing. It's just a habit. This is just a psychological tendency that we're trapped in. We just keep going, feeding it constantly. Now we're going to be given the tools to cut through it. But do we want to cut through it? That's the point. Do we want it? We have so much feedback from this. We don't want to see the true aspect of phenomena. If we're truthful with ourselves, I don't think we want to see the true aspect of phenomena, because we get so much feedback for our ego.
It seems like we're always reacting to the past, and the past doesn't exist.
That's right. All experience is memory. All experience is nothing new. In order for an idea about something to arise, we have to pull the idea from our memory. And that's what interprets the experience. So all experience is memory. Incredible, isn't it? Yeah. We really want to, you know, I want something new in my life. No, there isn't, actually.
And to other habits, it's almost like something is sometimes just like fighting me not to sit or not to watch.
Yeah.
Like, you know, oh, look, let's go and do this instead.
Mm.
No, is that just the ego, or?
Yeah. Just the resistance, the feeling of insecurity. Because, you know, you might see something.
Or it's sort of like it's protecting itself or something.
Yes. That's it. Mechanism protects itself. The mechanism is very intelligent. We call this mechanism ignorance. But it is an extraordinary intelligence. There's only one problem with this intelligence. This intelligence is two-way intelligence. It only functions between a subject and an object. Only. It's not a panoramic intelligence. It doesn't see clearly. So when we, you know, begin to taste what we call panoramic intelligence or primordial intelligence, we've got lots of names for it, Rekha, awareness itself, then this is more this open, spacious way of seeing. No fixations. Totally relaxed, totally open. So, you know, this is why we can't experience our own nature, because there's so much tension. Because of this dualistic fixation, this mechanism always, you know, going backwards and forwards between a subject and an object. It's full of tension. It's full of always desire, aversion or indifference. That's tension. There's no relaxation there. You're always manipulating, trying to get things in a certain way. This is why impermanence is so important to realize, you know, the changing nature of the phenomena. Just let whatever come and go, come and go, come and go. And then you don't have to react, you don't have to buy into those old tendencies of reaction. Essential. It's the way in. Impermanence is the way in. I I mean, you know, I've taught the same thing for years and years and years. I'm not teaching anything new, nothing new.
Well, by definition, we, if we never experience anything new. But isn't it more like a co-production? I know you're going to go into much more detail as to the way that consciousness arises. But so, of course, we have our knowledge, which we bring to a new moment as we look at the landscape and the sun is at a certain angle in the sky, and we interpret that. So we're not always experiencing the same thing at the same time, are we? We're not always experiencing the same thing.
No.
So do we experience anything new?
No.
I'd like some clarification.
Again, it depends on our concept of new. The way that we see things is constantly, you know, different interpretations. If we want to call one interpretation old and the other one new, then it would be new, wouldn't it? It would be in relationship to old.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no such thing as new unless you have another idea.
Mm. But you just said earlier that everything is memory.
Yes.
Mm. That's the interpretive of our process that we bring to new stuff that's coming in.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, new stuff.
Stuff.
Stuff. Let's say stuff. Let's look at how the senses work a bit longer. All right, now, when we have, when we don't have a reference point, then the self has nothing to relate to. So then, what happens to our ideas of inside and outside?
Yeah.
We begin to see the interdependence of how ego began. As ego began, the projections of ego also began. Totally interdependent. So then what happens here is the idea of self maintains its identity by its projections. By believing in the projections, the idea of self maintains its identity. So then when we see the projections are non-substantial, then the ego becomes transparent correspondingly. So important to look at these three characteristics. You know, Don Dickensi probably teaches you to look at the four seals, but I'm asking you to just look at three characteristics. One is to see that every phenomenon is changing moment by moment. Two, to understand that nothing has any substantiality unless we make it substantial through our concepts. Three, nothing exists from its own side, independent of our mind, independent of our mental projections. So we need to really go over this again and again and again. Otherwise, we're imprisoned in our conditioning. We just cannot. We cannot see a way out. We cannot see anything that's transparent. It will always appear as an objective world if we do not work with understanding these three characteristics. No phenomena are solid, that means everything's changing moment by moment. No phenomena are substantial. Substantiality is created through concept. And no phenomena exist from their own side independent of our perception. Right? Lizzie, you look puzzled.
I just changed my mind.
No. In this particular text, we're looking at what this idea of self consists of. And here we're talking about eight kinds or eight aspects of consciousness. This is the components of what make up this idea of self. Eight aspects of consciousness. Now, usually we consider just we have one consciousness, but here we're looking at different aspects of consciousness, how they all work together. So we have six sense consciousnesses. The five senses that we normally consider, we have the eye sense, eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, and the body consciousness, which is tactile consciousness. And then, in the East, we have a sixth consciousness. And the sixth consciousness is considered to be the conceptual mind itself. That is considered to be a consciousness, a sense. Because without that, all the information that's coming in through the five senses wouldn't be interpreted. So it's your sixth consciousness, your conceptual mind, which is like a switchboard. Remember those old switchboards, telephones with all the plugs going everywhere? Well, the sixth consciousness is like the operator. All the information is coming in through the five senses. And then the conceptual mind interprets what's coming in through the five senses, puts it together into one single event. I'm sitting here in this room in Pakok. Now, how many different moments of consciousness are involved in I'm sitting here in Pakok? Countless moments of consciousness. A moment of seeing, a moment of hearing, a moment of smelling, a moment of tasting, a moment of feeling, a moment of thinking, a moment of hearing. Constantly changing. Hundredths of a second, so fast, changing as the consciousness moves through the senses. And then the conceptual mind interprets what's going on. Oh, this is a bird, this is that, this is good, this is bad. And all of a sudden, the conceptual mind puts it together into one experience. Oh, I went to listen to Anisandra on Sunday. Now, this is what we don't see. And this is why we say we don't see the true aspect of the phenomena. We don't see all the conditions that are necessary in order to experience things in certain ways. We just put everything together and it becomes a solid experience. So we have five sense consciousness, we have the thinking mind, the conceptual mind, which is regarded as the sixth sense. Then we have what we call a seventh consciousness, and the seventh consciousness is regarded as a kind of nature of ignorance, because it is so cloudy. It's so imprecise. It doesn't see anything clearly, the seventh consciousness. And then it acts in a way as a filter on all the other six consciousnesses. It doesn't allow you to see anything clearly. So then you have confusion. It's a cloudy mind. And it runs through, it has a kind of overall structure which runs through all the six sense consciousnesses.
And then you flick then into it. You say you flick between the six consciousnesses, but the other one is on constantly all the time.
Yes.
It's kind of like an unconscious consciousness.
It's like that, a little bit. It works, as the seeds come up.
It's very different from the other six.
Yes, because of this dualistic fixation, the imprint of this dualistic fixation, this is what it holds, this imprint. So it always interprets things in a kind of dualistic way. And so then all the other six consciousnesses will see in this cloudy way. It doesn't see precisely or clearly what's actually happening.
It's more like a state of mind than a consciousness.
That's where the way it's expressed in the text. I haven't changed the expression. It's always 2,500 years it's been expressed that way as eight aspects.
I shall quarrel with it.
Yeah.
Why not?
Well, they could be right, you know.
I think we have to go on further. We need to really...
Yeah. I always have a problem with the final two consciousnesses.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, somebody else had a question?
As soon as your consciousness labels something, it becomes dualistic. As soon as the label or any definition is thereof, it is, if it is one thing, it isn't another, so therefore that's dualistic, correct?
Even before that, there is this tendency towards dualism.
Before the
labeling, but the labeling makes it more solid. Because we don't see precisely, we're not resting in our own nature. As soon as you're not resting in your own nature, there's this tendency towards dualistic fixation. And then all the other process just makes it more solid, more structured. So then we create more tendencies and more seeds for more dualistic fixation. So all the seeds of all experience, both what we call samsara and nirvana, that's both are believing in our projections. Samsara, okay, definition of samsara, the mind that believes in its projections. Nirvana, the mind that sees the nature of its projections.
Is motivation dualistic too?
Yes, of course.
So as soon as your motivation is...
Yes, constantly. But we use it as a support. We're using it as a means, as a tool to go beyond mental fabrication. This is the whole path. The whole path is fabricated. The whole path is dualistic. But we understand what we're doing. It's a very skillful tool. It's a way to go beyond all this. So you don't attach yourself to the path either. You use it as a support. Understanding that, you know, it's a skillful means itself. All spiritual paths, it's just a skillful means. But we get trapped so easily because, I'm coming to this, you know, a habit of ours. What's the habit in relationship to our spiritual path? How do we use our spiritual path usually?
To manipulate things.
Support the ego.
Control things.
Yes. We use our spiritual path as another way to secure our ego. Yeah. So it's used in the opposite way than the way that it's intended to be used. I'm a this, you're a that. I do this practice. You don't practice. You don't know these rituals. You don't go to church on Sundays. What do you think you're doing here?
But that is always the case.
I think in the majority of cases it is the case, yes. It's, you know, the need to identify. When, you know, how many spiritual paths are working directly on ego psychology? I think Buddhism is the only path that works directly That's the basis of the path. Most other paths are very dualistic. You know, there's always you and God. Until, of course, if you've done a lot of practice, then I'm sure the Gnostics, they had other experiences. You know, great Christian mystics.
What would you say? Maybe it's not a very good idea to call yourself a Buddhist or identify as a Buddhist, because that becomes another identification.
I'm
a more interesting person because I've become a Buddhist.
Yeah. My teacher, my first instruction, one of my first instructions from my main teacher was, whatever you do, don't ever think you're a nun. And I never knew how profound that instruction was until I looked around me and saw how rigid people could become, you know, when they did become monks and nuns, you know. So he just gave me the confidence to be natural. You know, I didn't have to be anything. And I think, that was most wonderful teaching. And so, you know, if you want to call yourself something, yeah, but realize it's just a name. It's nothing. You know.
It's what we do is important, not what we identify.
Yes.
I don't like the term Buddhist.
Yes, I think, you know, this book, I haven't read it. There's a reason why I'm not reading it, but I recommend everybody else reads it, because I don't want my teacher's book to affect my own book that I'm writing. See if I come up with the same ideas. Yeah, but I think, you know, it would be helpful if you can read Thondra Kensi Rinpoche's book. I think it's very helpful. What it means not to be a Buddhist. And it's very different than what we normally think. It involves perception, the way you see. If you see things as solid and unchanging, that is not the Buddhist path. So it's not about what you call yourself, but really about the way you see. Okay, let's go on a little bit. I can see people are getting tired here. It makes you stand up, jump up and down a bit. So the seventh consciousness is ignorance, cloudiness, confusion. And we could say the seventh consciousness is an absence of precision. It's very blind. The eighth consciousness is what we call the ground or the unconscious. And it's the ground that makes it possible for the other seven consciousness aspects of consciousness to function. And here I'm using two words for those of you who may have studied Buddhist texts before. Then we'll use two words here. One is called alaya, and the other is called alaya vijnana. So alaya is the basic ground, and the alaya vijnana is the eighth consciousness. So we could say that the alaya is like Himalaya, same root of the word. So Hima means snow, Laya means abode or home. So home of the snow, Himalaya. So here we have alaya means home of the consciousness or ground of the consciousness. So there's a difference between the nature and the ground of the consciousness. The ground of the consciousness is already involved in ignorance. It holds all the seeds for the ego psychology to function. So there is a kind of evolutionary process, and it starts from this unconscious ground, the eight consciousness. Then the cloudy consciousness arises from that, then the six consciousness arises from that, and then even the six consciousnesses have an evolutionary way of evolving as well, depending on the intensity of how they're used. It's a long study. It takes really months of study to really understand the details of how they all work together. This is just what I call a psychological survey. We're giving you a very kind of concise overview of the whole pattern. But I don't have time to really go into detail. It's something that I think everybody should try and study.
Can I ask one question? The line of consciousness is subject to impermanence, just like everything else.
Yes. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a possibility of awakening one's mind to its own nature. So these eight aspects of consciousness, we can say this is really on the level of the first of the five skandhas, form. This is what we call the form of the ego. Now, ego really doesn't have a form, but as far as form goes, we would say that these eight aspects of consciousness are the form of the ego. It gives you something tangible. It gives you a kind of grounding element to your idea of self. And even this doesn't go very far. So, from a relative point of view, these consciousness comprise of something fixed or something definite, on a relative point of view. Because you still believe that you know, there are eyes and ears and nose and all this. So it's still kind of fixed in the sense of the senses. Now, what happens? We could say the basic ground the nature of the mind is just a state of being in itself. There's no relative situations. It's just a state of being. Now, energies appear out of this basic ground. And those energies are the source of the development of relative situations. So maybe I've heard it expressed as sparks. Sparks of duality, sparks of wisdom, sparks of this, sparks of that. They like flash out of this basic ground. So the basic ground is the source of both confusion and also the source of liberation. And both confusion and liberation are both energies. And these energies are happening constantly. So these energies are described as something like clouds in the sky. They appear and dissolve back into the space of the sky. Now, for the idea of self, the ego's type of ground, the eighth consciousness, that arises when the energy flashes from this basic ground, and what happens is it causes a blinding effect. so that we cannot see clearly what's happening. And this confusion becomes the eight aspects of consciousness. Now, this is quite complex to understand, so please be patient. So we could say that the eight aspects of consciousness are an error that comes out of this phenomena that blinds. It's the speed of the energy is so fast that we cannot assimilate the speed. And so then we become bewildered by the speed of the energy. Instead of relaxing into the movement of the energy, there's a tendency to try to secure oneself. And the way we secure oneself is by having form, by trying to hold on to something. When you appreciate the nature of your own mind, then this total relaxation, there is no holding on to anything at all. When you can relax completely, then there's open spaciousness. There's no self, there's no other than self. But if you cannot work with movement, this is why, again, I come back to impermanence. It is so important to be able to just see the changing nature of the phenomena. And by appreciating the changing nature of the phenomena, one begins to relax. One doesn't try to hold on or secure oneself. One just sees everything arising, passing away, arising, passing away. And then everything becomes transparent because you're not holding on to anything. You become detached from what's happening. The more detached you are, the more clear. Because our reaction blinds us constantly. The habit of our reactions. So if we can go along with the process of speed, then there would be no need to panic. We would see that within movement there is stillness, and within stillness there is movement. Now we don't see. When something changes, then immediately, oh, what's that? Look at your own experience. For those of you who've done any practice whatsoever, see how you work with change. When something changes, what's the feeling? Unless you have really sat with observing how the mind works, arising, passing away, then you can just, there's stillness within the movement. It's like watching a river go by. It's very relaxing watching a river. Okay, let's have some questions here. It's very hard to understand unless one's done some practice.
Can I just clarify, you see the mind, is it, in your understanding, or is it simply made up of the ego? That's nothing else.
According to this definition, the mind is ego, synonymous with the word ego. So it only functions when there's duality, when there's an idea of a subject and an object. There's an object and something to perceive it. That's the only way it functions. It's a mechanism. It's not a thing. Not a thing. It never existed. It's an illusion that we believe exists. and we buy into this mechanism. It's become such a strong habit now that we don't. There's no way, you know, that we can see to let go of it.
Does it exist from birth, or does it
yes.
have to grow?
Yes, it depends how you. If you don't believe in previous lifetimes, then you can just see it from this lifetime. But if you believe in previous lifetimes, then it's been going on a long time. And we have this concept in Buddhism, beginningless time. You know, there's no beginning. Because time is another concept. Mm-hmm. That's very hard for people. Any other questions?
The first five consciousnesses are can they be, if they didn't have the sixth, seventh, and eighth, would they be being without the mind? Could they, like, because it's our mind that conceptualizes whether something tastes good or smells good or
yes.
feels nice.
Hmm.
Can they be without, like, can you experience those? You can't actually.
you answer your own question.
You know, I just
then.
Want there to be, like, I want my smell and my taste to. I wish there could be, like, a pure non mental thing, but we process it all through our heads, so it's impossible to get away from labeling those sensations as something other than good, bad, nice, or whatever. You can't.
I think the awakened mind sees in a very different way.
I read somewhere, I can't remember the specific numbers, but that there are thousands, just thousands of taste buds along our tongue in order to alert us to any harmful substance. So you don't have to, if you eat something that's off, you'll pick it up in a minute. You don't, without the concept necessarily, it just tastes bad. It's an aversive reaction, but it promotes survival.
Yeah, but it doesn't work.
Oh.
It doesn't work, does it? Look at how many people die from what they eat. If it worked, it wouldn't be that way. But how you read it every day, you read food poisoning, this one digested this, that. It doesn't work. Maybe it might have worked before, but now maybe it doesn't work anymore.
Well, I think a lot of toxic substances can be covered. But I think there's something inherent in our sensory apparatus that are designed for us to respond to beyond concepts because they promote survival.
I don't know. What do you think of that?
Some karma we have, which is human. It's human karma. It's not
yes.
individual. And that's what I think you're talking about.
Hmm.
Some of those filters are part of speech human beings. Don't have any difficulty with that.
Hmm. No, nobody's denying genetics. We're not saying nothing exists.
No.
You know, I mean, this is where we get caught all the time between nihilism and eternalism. Everything exists or nothing exists. There's nothing in between. There's nothing. There's no other way of seeing things. And in Buddhism, unfortunately, they introduce a completely different way of seeing things.
I think the point I'm making is that I think there are some reactions that are just inherent in our nature to that have a survival mechanism beyond, or that do not involve concepts. Few. But I think some those aren't the ones we need to work with.
Where do emotions fit in the consciousness? Are they part of the six consciousness? Emotions?
Again, the question comes up. Can you have an emotion without an object? So then which sense would be the emotion? When we look at the eight consciousnesses, and that is the only way you can experience life, there's no secret way, there's no other consciousness somewhere else, then, you know, you've got to fit everything into one of those consciousnesses. How does it work? How does emotion work in relationship to those eight aspects of consciousness? Is emotion something you see? But when we get angry at someone, you know, what senses are working then?
Our mind's not working when we're angry at someone. Because we're so busy being emotional, we're not thinking. Or we're
careful now. Slowly, slow down the process again. Let's take a magnifying glass.
We're so busy being emotional that we are thinking.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, we are thinking. But then how come we can't talk right when we're so angry? You know how when you stop and you're not being angry, you can talk and have a discussion with someone, but when you're really angry and caught up in the emotion, you can't even think. Because you're so busy being angry. Do you know what I mean?
Well, maybe you're still busy thinking. You can't think properly.
No, I disagree because along with what you were saying, the whole endocrine system is flooded. Just flooded. And that's why they'll often say in my field, take a time out to allow your lower brain stem, your amygdala, the seat of amount motion, to calm down, so that your higher function, your frontal lobe, can regain some cognitive control.
I'm confusing thinking with rational, conceptualizing a better word than thinking.
Yeah, conceptualizing. You have to have, look at the process. Forget about what you've learned.
I'm just saying that once you...
Don't get upset.
If I raise my voice, it doesn't mean I'm upset. When I'm not disputing what you're saying. I'm saying don't deny that there is also a hormonal response. And when that is intensely strong, you're not thinking with choice until those emotions calm down, until those hormones calm down.
Yeah, but we have a different approach. We have a very different approach to the idea of emotion. You have to see how the emotion is created. It's not created through the hormonal.
I'm not disputing that.
So then maybe there's a different approach to working with the emotion as well. First of all, you have to see how the emotion is created. If you see how you create the emotion, then you know directly how to work with the emotion. The habit that we've got into, then of course it causes all the other physical reactions. But that is because of the habitual energy patterns that we're so used to just following. But if you look at emotion, how does it work? What does it need to arise? This is what the question always, what conditions do we need for emotion to arise? It's not just the energy itself. The energy itself, without the object, is wisdom. That is wisdom. This is why in Vajrayana, we say that we can use, we can use all these aspects that we consider to be negative in a positive way, because within all this emotion there is wisdom. And this is only taught in Vajrayana. It's not taught in any of the other approaches of Buddhism. It's not taught in Mahayana or others. So, how does emotion arise? Okay, you tell me. I've told you many times, but you look at your own emotion. What do you need for your emotion to arise? Think, Sam. When you get angry, what do you need?
Control
yourself. Well, you need to control yourself, but first of all, what makes you angry? Think about it.
You've been offended in some way.
Your perception.
Yeah, but what is it? How does it work?
You need a thing and you need a thought about that thing.
Yes, thank you. I mean, he's heard me so many times, they can just recite this off automatically now. But, you know, if you look at your own mechanism of what happens, in order to get angry, you've got to have an object.
And a reason.
You've got to have an object, and then you've got to have a reference point. You've got to have a because. If you don't have a because, there's nothing to construct. You've got to make the object solid. As you're making the object more and more solid, there's a corresponding energy which comes from habitual patterns of reaction. If you can relax and just cut through the constructing mechanism, then everything just releases itself again and goes back into its own nature. So then you can use, you know, if you're skillful enough, you can use anger as a means to realize more and more your own wisdom nature. But that it takes confidence, it takes guts, it takes courage. You're not going to run away, you're not going to follow it, you're going to work with it. And most of us get lost in it. We get lost in the habit of the anger. We're already, you know, we get so much feedback from the construction. You know, the more solid the object becomes, then the more self-righteous we feel.
And also, your point about the chemicals that are released. Now, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know anything about that. And even if that's the case, I would argue that the habits were possibly, if you weren't in the habit of looking at your mind, the habits were every bit as they released, and that could be the jail for keeping you angry, as the chemicals were. So because if someone tells you that it's the chemicals, then you might think, well, what's the point of working with my mind, but it's coming up anyway. Someone is
only by working with your mind that you can get a hold of it. You can transform those.
Okay, so let's go back to the some examples here. And one example that doesn't come from me is it's like driving a car very fast. Now, when you're driving a car very fast, those of you who can drive, if you go along with the speed, there's no problem. But if you panic and you say, wow, I'm driving too fast, and you put your foot on the brakes, it's very likely that you can have an accident at that moment because of the panic. You're not going along with the speed. And this is similar to what happens with our own mind. The speed of the change of the phenomena. We don't know how to relate to this changing phenomena.
Isn't it that fast?
Yes. Incredible. Hundreds, 500ths of a second. We can't even, it's not,
yeah,
it's,
yeah,
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 you can't,
think of it.
Can't even think of it. Yeah. And so fast, it's like a projector, you know, like making a movie, all the frames.
Yeah.
You put all the frames together, it looks like something continuous. That's a really good example of how the consciousness works. So you have a moment of seeing, moment of hearing, moment of thinking, moment of seeing, moment of tasting, moment of it. So fast. And then the conceptual mind, again, comes and relates, pulls from memory all the information and puts it all together. Oh, that was very nice. That's, you know, oh, that's much more beautiful than I've ever experienced before. Makes it into one thing. And we think it's something continuous, but it's not. It's these constant moments arising, passing away, arising, passing away. And it's only when you sit and practice and you really observe the mind that you can really begin to see more and more this changing nature. Then it becomes more transparent, more transient. We can relax, we can let go. Until we see the changing nature, we cannot let go. Agreed completely. The parrot.
Echo. Echo.
He's holding on very tight.
He lives in the tree outside the window.
Is it
a
wild parrot?
Yeah, it's a cockatoo, white one.
What time did you start?
In the morning, early. It's funny how it's, you know, come to Eric. Feels safe and secure here. He doesn't know what Eric liked to do with it. All right. So, it's about not working with speed. So what happens is, instead of flowing with the changing phenomena, we try to put the brake on, and when we try to put the brake on, there's a tendency to freeze everything, to make it solid. You getting the feeling? Anybody who's done any practice? As soon as you are not, you lose the ability to relax, to let go, then the tendency is to freeze and solidify. You see your own practice. And this is what happens then, is we don't know how to relate to the situation. And then the situation takes you over. Your projection takes you over. If we are relaxed, then we will see how the phenomena is changing moment by moment. You don't hold on to anything. You see everything very clearly. There's no habitual tendencies of pulling towards you, pushing away for you, or indifference. I use another example. You have two ice cubes in a bowl of water. Are the ice cubes different from the bowl of water? Or are they the same as the water? different or the same?
The same.
Same but
the same but different.
Yes.
So what makes it different?
Conditions.
Conditions, all right. That's the only, it makes the appearance, yes, different under certain conditions. So this is exactly how the mind works. When you don't appreciate the nature of the phenomena, there's a tendency to freeze the phenomena. And then you freeze it into a subject and an object. Whereas both are illusory, completely illusory. All right, I think we'll stop there today. And we're just beginning form now, we're just getting into form.
Excuse me, can you just repeat that last sentence again about the ice cubes?
Yeah, well, you have to ask yourself, you know, whether the ice cubes are the same or are they different from the water. For most people, they appear different from the water. Then you have to ask yourself, why do they appear different from the water?
Yeah, what's the next line, please?
Well, under certain conditions, then those ice cubes will melt and they will go back into their own nature again. So then, whilst you hold on and identify with the ice cube as being an entity, as being something different, then it will continue to maintain itself as an ice cube, continue to freeze the conditions into a self and an object.
Excuse me.
Well, sorry, I've forgotten what I actually said.
So
watch the video.
The video.
Reaction to think in a negative way. Yes, but, yes, but, yes, but. And the way he creates his fear is he focuses on what if, what's going to go wrong. And I was talking to him yesterday about, well, if you can create a thought in one direction, you know, you can create it in another thought, blah, blah, blah. And I don't want it, I want it to go away. And he's an anxious all his life, it just never caused him a problem before. Rather than push it away, you know, if you'll invite it in, etc. But I'm going away for a couple of weeks, and I've given him hypnosis tapes. I mean, I'm helping him, working with him on a variety of levels. But I frankly admitted defeat at least yesterday, and so I recommended a pill for him to take. He only needs to take it in these situations of anticipatory anxiety. What will happen if he takes this pill is that no matter how much he catastrophizes, his body will not respond with anxiety. He will remain calm. As a result, what I predict, because it's happened so many times before with other people, is that he will stop. He will stop catastrophizing. The problem is that he will relate it to the pill. And I'll bet that he won't learn that he doesn't have to think in this in his usual way, that he really does have choice. So I know what the downside is going to be.
Not Millie, what's the name of this pill?
Enderol. A lot of people in the Philharmonic, when they have anxiety, It's a very old beta block. But what I'm thinking is so interesting with this is that I know his body is not going to respond. Usually the body responds to his thoughts, and he becomes more anxious, and his voice gets quaky, and then he becomes very frightened that people can see his heartbeat and hear just how scared he is. What's the con? Heavy German accent. So I just think it's interesting to separate out when you have a catastrophic thinking that doesn't trigger an emotional response. Can that maybe with other people at least break the habitual mind-body response pattern so you have more choice in how you think? As I say, it's not the best way to deal with it, really.
No, I think the way to break the habitual thought patterns is to one day create the person in one way and the next day create them in another way and keep doing that, creating them as the best thing in the world and then the worst thing in the world and keep going backwards and forwards so that you really get used to the ability that you can create them in whatever way you want to create them.
I've been doing something similar by encouraging him to have all these negative thoughts, then have a neutral one and a positive one to get the idea that he's playing with it. But he says, yeah, but they don't feel real. Only the negative feels real.
Yeah, well, that's usually the way that we, not only him, that's the way that most of us relate. You know, the negative seems far more real than the positive. Yeah, it really takes time. It takes a lot of practice. You know, emotionally, the patterns that we set up on an emotional level, they can only be weakened through practice. There's really no intellectual games that we can play with ourselves to weaken these patterns. The intellectual obscurations, what we call obscurations, yes. We can have some ideas, we can contemplate these ideas, then we change our ideas, our concepts about things. That's much easier to do, work with the intellectual obscurations, but the emotional obscurations, only practice over and over again. Seeing things in a different way, becoming familiar with a different way of seeing, again, 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 looking at change and impermanence, change. Again, you see it. You see how your feelings change. You look back at your feelings. You know, you think about the worst time in your life, and you ask yourself, did it remain the same? You go back to the best time in your life, and you ask yourself, did it remain the same? And of course, you say, no, it didn't.
Well,
so then, why should this remain the same?
He concedes, after a lot of talking, that his excess adrenaline is metabolized within 5 minutes. And then he can speak effectively, or relatively effectively. And you'd think, just knowing that, if you can use the example of surfing, just surfing, just allowing them to come and go ashore, if you're feeling. And anticipatory anxiety doesn't work. Logic has nothing to do.
Give it time. You know, give it time. First of all, he has to trust you as a psychotherapist. You know, if he trusts you, then he'll apply your methods. And if you say to him, well, keep doing it over and over again, then something will happen. But if he only tries it once and it doesn't work, then he'll give up. You know, he won't be inspired to keep going. You have to be inspired to keep going.
Well, I think the most painful message is you have to work with it. Resist it and hope it'll go away.
Yeah, but then it comes back to the same question that I asked, you know, in the beginning of the teaching. You know, the same question. Where do we think the problem is? Do we think the problem is something internal or something external? Until we get this clear, then we're not willing to work with it. You know, we'll always find an excuse. We'll always blame something or depend on something, our feelings. So we have to be clear, you know. Is it real or it's not real? Does it exist internally or externally? And then slowly we see the interdependency between internal and external. It's not, you can't have an outside unless you have an idea of inside. For example, I go out in the garden and there's space, it's just an open field. But then I build something with four walls and you have an inside and an outside. And you actually believe that there's an inside and an outside. And this is what we do with the body. We actually believe that there's an inside and an outside, and they're two something totally separate things. Ridiculous. But this is how we've habituated ourselves to see things in a very solid way that we believe that. So it's only by working with your projections, by seeing the objective world is not the way I think it is, over and over again, things begin to loosen up. Then you can see that everything is workable. It really works that way. This is why you have to, well, if it's the way you think it is, then why don't I see it that way? Why doesn't this person see it that way? What makes you see? Then people begin to think, well, yeah, why don't they see it in the same way? Why do I see something like that in the morning and I see it differently in the afternoon? All this, it makes the projection more workable. It's not something solid, it's something we can play with. You understand? Very important.
Often people understand a little bit this kind of thing, but it's the feeling, they'll say it feels so real.
Of course it feels real. It feels real to us after how many years of practice.
They know that other people next to them are having a grand time and they're about to have a heart attack.
Yeah, but you know, you're telling him, but at the same time you believe it's real. So
he's so instructive to me because I said, you know, I see what he's doing and it validates the teaching because it's so clear.
No, but I mean, I'm not laying a trip on you. I'm just saying that you're trying to tell him that it's not real, but at the same time you believe that it's real because you still relate to things in a way that you see it as real.
And I respect his experience. Yeah. And to invalidate that would be very disrespectful.
Yes, yeah, so, you know, it's important to understand that, you know, the conditioning makes us see things in certain ways. And it's very hard to break loose of this. You'd have to be very skillful in how you open people to a different way of seeing. You have to approach that way and that way and that way and that way and that way. And slowly they get more confidence to let go of their old habits of perception. But you need to be skillful. Okay, so let's have our closing prayers where we dedicate all the positive energy that we've cultivated here today. And don't just keep it for yourself. Think about, you know, how this energy can benefit others. And then we say some prayers for the long life of our own teachers. And this is how we close our session. If you don't want to do the prayers, you don't have to do the prayers. You can just sit, relax, and we'll do the prayers.
The Red Tarot Dedication Prayer. Throughout my many lives and until this moment, whatever virtue I have accomplished, including the merit generated by this practice and all I will ever obtain, is my offer for the welfare of all sentient beings. May sickness, war, famine, and suffering be decreased for every being. May their wisdom and compassion increase in this and every future life. May I clearly perceive all experiences to be as insubstantial as the green fabric of the night, and instantly awaken to perceive the pure wisdom display in the arising of every phenomena. May I quickly attain enlightenment in order to work ceaselessly for the liberation of all sentient beings. Buddhism, bodhisattvas, all together, whatever kind of motivation you have, whatever kind of beneficial action, whatever kind of wishing prayers, whatever kind of omniscience, whatever kind of life accomplishment, whatever kind of benevolent power, and whatever kind of immense wisdom you have, then similarly I who have come in the same way to benefit beings, pray to attain these qualities. At this very moment, for the peoples and the nations of the earth, may not even the names, disease, famine, war, and suffering be heard. Rather, may their moral conduct, merit, wealth, and prosperity increase, and may supreme good fortune and well-being always arise for them. Rinpoche's long life prayer. Sorry, long rebirth prayer.
Swift
Namo Guru Mantra Shriya Nijaram Netam Pacha Hiku Rangan Mundrotam Perum Kushar Dunje Samnam Chukujo Dantan Kusam Yerme Lava Somarem Yerme Nam Jam Nektong Prabhura Dunje Jam Banda Che
the truth of the dependent arising,
for the life of Gandhi's Ambitism, for me, for benefit beings like myself. Longevity prayer for all lamas. Foundation way ne ching po, tampayan ring ne pa dang, tampayan be jabo, gu te chao tan tan jer che, duzum zanje guru rimboje, nu drapun dang diwa jimbo za, bar che kun tel du du drapo tao, so wa dim so jin ji la tu so, jing an san we bar che ji wa da, tampayan ji drapa jin ji lo. And no chosen bring no chase, and sing some jabber bell, Joshi chim some what media do song give a shock. Sorry.
I was going to do a nice slow long.
Oh.
Thanks, but. Okay, so nice to see you all. I hope that I will see you again. I hope you'll find today beneficial. Thank you. Please have some tea.
Thank you.